Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone and Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
We've got to warn people.
What do you see?
The Howling. Somewhere in this city, in this human jungle, it begins.
What do you see?
What's there, Karen?
What do you see, Karen?
What's there?
Somewhere in these woods, in this primal, sensuous, secret place, lies an experience too terrifying for words. And now, all anyone can do is watch and wait.
Tonight I'm going to show you something. Make you believe.
Welcome to the Projection Booth. I'm your host, Mike White. Joining me is Mr. Rob St. Mary.
Their wolf, their castle.
Why are you talking that way?
I thought you wanted to.
No, I don't want to.
Suit yourself. I'm easy.
We're also joined this week by our old buddy, Josh Hadley of Radiodrome, Lost in the Static, and the What the F*** podcast.
Among others.
Oh. This week we're talking about Joe Dante's 1981 film The Howling, one of several werewolf films released in the same year. The Howling stars Dee Wallace Stone as newswoman Karen White, no relation. She has been stalked by sexual deviant Eddie Quist, and after a terrifying run in with Quist, goes on a retreat with her husband where she's surrounded by rather interesting mix of people, including a kooky old man, a sex kitten, and assorted other odd characters. I've seen the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, hysterical, naked. Now let's let the fur fly and get into The Howling. I'll start things off this week by saying that I'm kind of a Howling noob. I've seen bits and pieces of it before and things like Terror in the Isles, but I've never actually seen the whole thing or never all the way through until just a few weeks back. I've always been more of an American Werewolf in London kind of guy. So since I've watched this one, I had to sit down and watch every single damn Howling movie since then so that I know what I'm talking about. Oh my God. All right. So Rob, what's your history with The Howling, buddy?
Well, first off, I want to apologize for that because I brought up The Howling originally because I was confused. Like, you were talking about all these different movies that came out, these werewolf movies. I remember The Howling and I hadn't seen it in a long time. I remember it from my youth. You see, in Detroit, back in the 80s, they had this horror movie showcase on like Saturday and Sunday afternoons on channels 20 and 50.
Lock your doors, close your windows, turn out your lights for thrills and chills await you every Saturday afternoon at 2 on the TV 20 Thriller Double Feature. stay with a friend, say your prayers as grisly ghouls close in to seal your doom. You won't sit still as demons, mummies, and mysterious forces hunt down their victims and cause your blood to run cold from the terror you'll experience on the Thriller Double Feature. Every Saturday at 2 p.m. right here on TV 20.
And back then, I think I saw The Howling, maybe I was 5, 6, 7, 8 years old, whatever. And the only thing I really remembered about it was the transformation scene and that it made me hungry for hamburgers for some reason. But I do have to say that outside of American Werewolf in London, which I think was a year later, it probably has the best metamorphosis scene in the early 80s with all those damn werewolf movies that you're going to see.
As far as I know, I want to say that American Werewolf in London, The Howling, and Wolfen, and got Full Moon High. So it seems like there's one more out there that all came out in 1981. So I don't know what was in the air in 81, but there was something, or 80, since they were probably all produced in 80 and then released in 81. Little too early to be blaming Reagan for this phenomenon. I don't know what it was, if we're feeling inept after the whole hostage situation or what it was. But yeah, something was going on where it was just like werewolf fever back then. So Josh, what's your history with the film?
I actually saw them out of order. I saw The Howling 2 was a staple of HBO, Cinemax, and late night cable. So I saw that one with Sybil Danning's overused breasts long before I ever saw the first film. First film was a staple of UHF television, because that one didn't really require a whole lot of editing. That one played on late night TV constantly. So I saw that one after I saw the second one, and then I saw all the sequels as they originally came out on video, much to my chagrin. Although, Mike, I have a feeling you were a little bit worse seeing them all in a relatively short period of time instead of a year or two between each one.
Yeah, that was quite a marathon.
Yeah, I at least had a break between each one when I was waiting for the video release. But the first film, I didn't get all the subtext at first because obviously, just like Rob, I was really little when I saw it. I just thought it was a pretty cool werewolf movie. I didn't get the amazing cast or the subtext or the comedy. And I liked it better than American Werewolf in London. Maybe I'm about to be bludgeoned for that. I don't know, but I think it's a better film.
You were talking about all of these sequels and just the number that you had to sit to back to back to back to back. I think probably the second worst sort of like sequel lineup like that would have been all those Witchboard movies.
I wonder what the worst series in filmdom is, like the series that just won't die, that just keeps coming back. You know, and that it actually started with a good movie. I mean, we should probably put that out there, too. I mean, what was the one that started with something good? Because you can't say Saw, and you can't say the Fast and the Furious movies. So, you know, what else is there? Is it Halloween? Would you consider that to be on par with The Howling and how the sequels went? I mean, but then again, I liked Halloween 3, but then again, I like The Howling 3. I thought that was actually pretty darn good.
I might go out on a limb and say Children of the Corn, because those got pretty ridiculous as they progressed.
They made more than one of those?
Yeah, they had 7 or 8, I think.
Holy shit. Really?
Wow. Yeah, and they had a remake last year on the Sci-Fi Channel.
Oh my god, I didn't know there was more than one of those. That is crazy.
Well, and Rob, I think you meant the Witchcraft movies, not the Witchboard movies, because those have 13.
That's right. That's what I was talking about. Imagine having to sit through all those, Mike. I'm sorry that I forced you to sit down and watch all these damn Howling movies.
I watched all the Witchcraft movies as they came out, too. I was a video store junkie. Blame me.
Not only did I watch all the movies, I also read the books, too. And the book of The Howling and the movie of The Howling, so completely different. There are some similarities here and there. I think the main character's name, Karen, but it's even spelt differently between the two. But there are a couple things, you know, our main character gets attacked at the beginning and goes off to a secluded location, relatively secluded, where she's surrounded by a group of interesting. Can we do spoilers on this one? Can we free our hands from this one?
It's a 30-year-old movie. Come on.
Okay. So she's surrounded by werewolves. Who's the werewolf is basically what we're playing, or when is the original werewolf going to come back? Who's played by Robert Picardo? What's going to happen? How's she going to get out? Once she's out in the woods, what's going to happen? And it's her and her husband, and there's tension between their marriage. So really, they're, as far as those broad strokes that I just kind of painted, those are kind of similar, except Robert Picardo, unfortunately, is not in the novel. I will say that, you know, himself, Robert Picardo, not the character, but the actor, is not in the novel. So, which is a shame, because I think Robert Picardo really adds to any book that you read.
So you read the book, you read the screenplays, you've watched the movies. You know, when we talk about the first one, let's talk about the first one. Let's get into the first one, because that's the one we really want to talk about. I really like this one, and I'll tell you why I really like it, is the story, it's kind of loose. It kind of gets better once D. Wallstone gets to the, you know, the group of all the weirdos. But the thing that I really like is, man, it's like if you're a film fan, there's so many cameos and small roles with people you just absolutely love. I mean, Kevin McCarthy is her boss at the TV station. Slim Pickens, John Carradine, John Sayles, who also co-wrote the script, and Dick Miller. I mean, Dick Miller, as the owner of this occult bookstore, is just great. And all of this stuff is just so much fun, especially if you have the background in horror film. Like Josh was saying, when I first saw it, I didn't know who these people were because I wasn't hip enough yet. I was only like 7. But now, looking back on it, it's so good.
Well, I like that Dick Miller is even playing Walter Paisley, the same character that he played in Bucket of Blood all those years ago. So that was kind of nice to see him, you know, even more of a nod. Not only is Dick Miller in it, but also playing the same character name as Bucket of Blood. And yeah, it was great to see. I mean, especially Carradine just is amazing. And it was great because when I watched this, I just watched Captain's Courageous on TCM, like, I think literally like hours before, where it's one of his early roles and he's barely recognizable because he's just so young and lanky and all this. And then, you know, 2 hours later, I'm watching The Howling and it's like, and his face comes up on screen, the biggest life. It's like, oh, wow. You know, I didn't know he was even in this film. This is great. And yeah. And did you say Patrick McNee? Because that is great to see him show up as well.
Hey, absolutely. And you've also got Roger Corman in that kind of in-jokey cameo that he has. And one of the great things is that while Dick Miller is playing Walter Paisley, he technically can't be because Walter Paisley died, but he's also played Walter Paisley in Hollywood Boulevard. He's also played Walter Paisley in The Burbs. That was what his character's name was. You can see it on his garbage man jacket. He's played Walter Paisley in almost everything Joe Dante has done.
I think he even branched out and did him in Chopping Mall, too.
Yeah, he might have been Walter Paisley in that, too.
Always great to see Dick Miller in anything. And then I had watched The Hole recently, Joe Dante's last film, and seeing him show up in there as the pizza boy is just, like, nice.
Oh, very and
nice.
Wasn't Forrest Ackerman one of the customers at Dick Miller's store in The Howling, too?
He was, yeah.
Carrying a famous Monsters magazine, if I remember correctly.
Shameless promoter that he was. And then, yeah, even Jonathan Kaplan shows up at one point as a gas station attendant. Jonathan Kaplan, one of my favorite kind of undersung directors. So that was great to see him show up.
Well, and then you've also got the future Captain Freedom on Hill Street Blues as one of our main characters. And you got Belinda Blasky, who another Joe Dante regular who was cute as hell in The Howling. She was the best friend, second banana, whatever. You got to see her chest all ripped open in the barn scene at the end.
I like, too, that there's that kind of double narrative that's going on, even though sometimes I don't know if it necessarily works, because we've got the whole D. Wallace Stone thing with her going up to this kind of hunting lodge for rich weirdos, and then we've got a couple of her buddies from the TV station who are there investigating, kind of back in the old hometown, investigating what was going on with this Eddie Quist character and finding his room and all the drawings of werewolves and all this kind of stuff. And it's almost like they don't have enough of those guys at the beginning that I actually remembered where they were from, because I don't even think it's until like maybe like the 40-minute mark where they kind of come back into the story. And we've really been kind of following Dee Wallace through so much of this stuff that they were kind of, you know, they were side characters to begin with. And then all of a sudden they're kind of thrust into the main part. And it's like, well, actually, these guys are a little bit more interesting than Dee Wallace is, which is kind of weird.
I have a feeling they were the victims of editing, because some of the deleted scenes on the DVD, most of them involve those two characters. So I have a feeling they were just edited out in post.
in the screenplay, there's definitely a lot of stuff that isn't there in the finished film. And you can hear on the audio commentary, to your point, Josh, there's a lot of stuff where it's like, didn't we film this? Oh, yeah, we had that scene there. What happened to that scene? And just, you know, the actors and Dante talking about, you know, what had happened and just the way they kind of, you know, were a little fast and loose when it came to getting things done, because this was a fairly low budget production and they weren't necessarily 100% beholden to the script. But, I mean, the script is pretty darn solid, I have to say.
For me, this film also, in terms of structure, this is a movie that you can't make nowadays. And it's not because there's something in it that's really expensive. It's just the structure of it. It's too slow for most modern audiences. I mean, outside of the attack scene that she has in the porno shop with the guy who turns into the werewolf, there's really nothing that happens until 20 minutes before the end of the film. So it's a lot of dialogue. It's a lot of characters. It's a lot of people freaking out and being scared of things. And then there's a couple of things here and there. But I think it's probably a too slow of a film for modern audiences today.
I think part of that might go to Dante was trying to build mood, I think, because he talks about it on the commentary. He uses color and fog and shadows so well. I think he was trying to build a mood rather than be exciting. And maybe as a kid, I didn't appreciate that. But as an adult and a film fan, I appreciate that way more now than I would have then.
Yeah, and I agree with you on that. I do appreciate it as well. I mean, I really enjoy it. I really enjoy the mix, the comedy, you know, the various things that are in it, as we talked about, the cameos and things like that, and the stuff that those people bring in with them, either as actors or within your own film history. You know, if you know who they are, it just adds an extra level. It's really nice.
And I showed this movie back when I worked at Channel 32. I showed this movie one Halloween, and I was trying to play it relatively serious. I hadn't started trying to be funny yet. And it got quite a decent response. So I have a kind of a special connection with this movie, that this is the one that kind of put me on TV to embarrass myself for the first time.
One person that I really appreciate in the movie is Elizabeth Brooks. Maybe not the best actress in the world, but I really like her look that's going on in this film. She was the one that played Marcia Quist, the sister of Eddie, and the kind of sex pot role.
She was just a little creepy, really. I think that was the point, but she's still a little creepy even today.
Well, I don't know. Just something about her. I don't know if it was her eyes or what it was, but just she was doing it for me.
She had that whole kind of like S&M thing going on, right?
Yeah, it's the S&M Native American witch kind of stuff.
Dominatrix? I mean, I'm sorry. I mean, I'll throw over Dee Wallace for her.
I still got to go Belinda Blasky if we're going that route. let's go back to the budget for a second. We've all three of us have pointed out it's relatively low budget. Am I the only one that thinks it doesn't really feel that way, though? It feels like Dante knew what he was doing. I think his use of color and sort of the longer takes and using the environment gives it more of a scope than a movie of its budget, which I think was only a little over $1 million in 1980, should have.
Well, I definitely think that he did well to balance the story with the werewolf stuff. I mean, because, you know, the werewolf effects were probably where a lot of the budget was going to go. And I think it was smart that he doesn't really go overboard with the werewolf stuff. He uses that very sparingly. And yeah, but yeah, you're right. When it comes to like just the atmosphere and the way that opening looks, it does look like he used all the money that he had, definitely.
What I really like about the first Howling film is that it's a place where if you're a fan of several of the people that worked on this film, this is sort of a place where you can sort of see it start to build and start to see like their abilities come through. Like, I mean, obviously Joe Dante, who would go on to do the various things that he's done since. I mean, a few years later, he'd have Gremlins, which is a huge hit, and then go on to do the stuff that he's doing now. But for me, being a big indie film fan, it's also interesting to watch because of John Sayles, both in his small role in there, which is kind of fun as the morgue attendant, but also in terms of the writing. So it's interesting from that aspect to see this guy who goes on to be like one of the most important sort of independent filmmakers of the last 25 years and starts off in exploitation, but having fun with it, you know, between this and Piranha, which both him and Joe Dante had worked on about a year or two before.
Right, and I like the story, too, that he was working on the script for The Howling and Alligator at the exact same time. And I think Dante talks about it on the audio commentary, where it's like, you know, depending on who was knocking at the door, he would, like, you know, rip the paper out and put the, you know, the other script in the typewriter to be like, oh, yeah, I've been working on your movie. Don't worry about that other one.
There's a couple of moments where he also says he thinks he might have accidentally gotten some alligator pages, too. But the other thing is that this was an Avco Embassy film. And Avco Embassy was really trying to do, I guess, on a smaller scale, what Canon tried to do later in the 80s, larger looking movies with wide theatrical releases that didn't look as low budget as they were. Because this came out right at the in the same lump as Prom Night, Escape from New York, The Fog, Psychic Killer, and a bunch of those other Avco Embassy films. And I think Avco Embassy, they had the right idea with this movie. They gave you your budget and they kind of told you what you were going to do. And then they left Dante alone to do what he needed to do. Same thing like they did with Carpenter and whatnot. I think Avco Embassy also played a big role in this movie's success.
Yeah, well, I want to say, didn't the producer even say, like, the shot that they used for the whole ripping of the, you know, the way that the Howling title comes on, that that was made just for the preview? And they said, no, that's too good. You got to throw it into the movie.
It was something along those lines, yeah.
Josh, you had mentioned the cameo from Corman and that kind of nice nod to Rosemary's Baby. I don't know if it was just that or if there was something else going on, but I kept thinking of Rosemary's Baby through the entire film. So when it turned out that the rest of the people at the colony, that they were werewolves, I was just like, oh yeah, that makes total sense. You know, it just kind of reminded me of the whole, you know, apartment building where Rosemary lived, that, you know, all of them witches. It was just like, oh yeah, that makes total sense. Was that just me? Was that just the Rosemary's Baby reference with Corman, or was that something else?
I didn't pick up on that, so that one might just be you.
That's fair enough.
Well, the other thing is, and, you know, obviously you read the book. Do you think that there are any deeper sort of subtext or society issues that he's sort of grappling with when it comes to The Howling, the novel? I mean, because it came out, what, late 70s? So this is like post-Manson and Vietnam and all that stuff. Do you think he's making any comment, or is it just a straight-ahead horror novel?
It's fairly straight-ahead, though I have to say that there's at least one character in there. Like, as I was sitting down and watching all of them in a row, I was starting to pick up on kind of religious subtext that was going on. And that really wasn't in the Dante Howling, but it was in Bradner's book, where there was one of the characters that helped out Karen was a former nun and who had had a lesbian affair and got kicked out of the convent and all this kind of stuff. I don't know if I was kind of picking up on that, but then we've got a priest at the end of two where there, it seems like he's kind of in league with a werewolf. And then there are these werewolf nuns in number three. And just it kind of goes through the rest where I could see more of this kind of religious angle to things. And just the way that, you know, I don't know if it was like the church was trying to cover stuff up or that, you know, because there's not that whole connection where you've got Lucifer in league with, you know, vampires and the whole, you know, the cross and all that kind of stuff. Werewolves are werewolves, and they represent our baser human experiences, our desires. They're like that kind of, you know, embodiment of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde type of. There was even a part where I was watching one recently, and I was just like, oh, he's about to Hulk out, you know, talking about that whole, like, there are times, too, where they even say, like, oh, yeah, if you're going to turn into a werewolf, you know, you got to watch your emotions, because as soon as you get angry, you're going to turn into a werewolf. So it's like, all right, that's kind of interesting. But yeah, I don't know where they were going with the religious stuff or if I was just reading into that. But as far as some sort of deeper meaning, really, it seemed like there was more to the sexual aspect when it came to the book. The initial attack that happens in the movie happens in an adult bookstore, but it happens in the woman's home in the book, and it's actually this guy that works for the apartment complex where she lives who comes in and attacks her, rapes her, violent rape, bites her on the thigh, and whenever her husband goes to have any kind of contact with her later on, she just freezes up and basically kind of is pushing him out of the marriage, and that's why he goes to the Marcia Quist type character a little bit easier in the book. Then again, he kind of goes to her fairly easy in the movie, and it's like, oh, you're just throwing her over pretty quick here, dude.
I kind of got the implication in the movie that it was almost like a hypnotism, because he seemed almost enthralled with her on like a siren type level in the movie, though. Maybe that was something that was cut, or I was reading too much into it.
I can kind of see that. I mean, there is this kind of unspoken desire that goes on between them, even between the characters in the book, where it's like, as soon as they go into, in that one, she runs a little store, and as soon as he comes into her store, their eyes meet, and there's this immediate sexual chemistry, and then there's this kind of whole thing where you can walk from her store to their house fairly easy if you take this back way through the woods. So it's kind of this whole secret, hidden kind of stuff, and, you know, yeah, I can kind of see that. And then, yeah, she definitely, they talk about her eyes, just the way that he's drawn to them, and I think they even say that she has kind of an oriental look to her eyes. And she is a fairly major character in the second book, which really is very much picks up like maybe 2 years after the first book. And it's basically like Karen on the run from her husband who didn't die, who turned into a werewolf, and this Marcia character, and them going from place to place to place trying to get her, and all these gypsies either helping or stopping them. So really not very much, you know, there's none of that that I see in the subsequent Howling movies, though there's some stuff in the Howling 3, very odd, in the Howling book 3, I should say. At the very end of the book, the main character, who is a reluctant werewolf, ends up going into a circus and becomes part of the freak show. So kind of there's elements of 6 when it comes to that, but not that many. It's like, you know, maybe 2 or 3 chapters in the book, and it's really, you know, kind of glossed over, as opposed to 6, which pretty much takes place at a circus.
In terms of the books, how many are there, and are they just adaptations of the film, or are they their own thing?
They're definitely their own thing. There's 3 of them. Yeah, 1 and 2 have the same main character, Karen White, though she's called Karen something else in the book. And then the 3rd one is a different story, though they make references to Drago, or Drago, which is the city where all of the stuff takes place in in book 1. And that's where all the stuff takes place in The Howling 4, which is a much closer adaptation of the book, though it differs severely. Like the stuff I was talking about with the attack, with the guy that rapes the main character, that's not in the movie. It's like this different thing that sets her on her path, and they kind of mix her character with her husband's character. It's an interesting take on it, but I have to say that the way that Sales adapted it was definitely better than the way that they kind of tried to be a little closer when it came to 4.
4 is also boring as hell. I mean, at least Sales kept things interesting, and I think Dante kind of pushed him towards this. He really tried the social satire. They were really satirizing, frankly, out-of-date social trends now. But if all of us remember those social trends, so I still think it works in the first film.
Are you talking like there's that part when they go to the colony where the woman is saying, like, I've tried EST, I've tried Scientology, I've tried this, I've tried that, and none of them have worked. So she's trying this, you know, teaching of this doctor?
Well, that and just all of the, you had the little smiley face thing, you had the whole social repression of keeping the beast inside rather than the beast being out in the open, and you had all these other little things that were just basically social hooey that was going around at that time.
And also, I remember at one point towards the end, there's a reference to Jonestown and Guyana. So it's interesting how the whole idea of cult and things like that kind of worked their way in as well.
So of all the sequels, I have to say that I actually like number 3 the best.
I will agree with that, with the one caveat that the second one is the most fun.
There is some fun in the second one, though it's weird. Sex is just running rampant through number 2. I mean, everything with that one, it's like werewolf orgy through so much of that movie.
Sybil Danning's repeated breast shot throughout the opening credit or the closing credits.
Oh, that was great. All time to the music. That was great. Seeing Christopher Lee wearing the wraparound shades at the beginning, the punk rock kind of thing. I was like, oh, yeah.
And you also got Reb Brown doing his famous numerous times in that.
Oh, yeah. God. Yeah, he was amazing. Just so stiff. And then the whole, your sister is a werewolf as the subtitle was like, yeah.
My Laserdisc does not say that. My Laserdisc has Sterbo Werewolf Bitch for the subtitle.
Oh, very nice. You know, I noticed that the subtitle of part 7 is Mystery Woman on the copy I have, but then it seems to be like New Moon or something. I can't remember what it
is. New Moon Rising.
Yes, but it's not Mystery Woman on there.
Well, I think we should back up a little bit and go through each one of the sequels chronologically instead of jumping around like we were. Because if people haven't seen them, we probably just lost half the listenership.
So number 2, Your Sister's a Werewolf.
I love the movie because it's got Reb Brown in it. I swear, and Reb Brown kind of hinted at this in an interview he did once, that the script was not a Howling script. It wasn't even a werewolf. It's clear when you watch the movie that this was originally written as a vampire story. Because in this, the werewolves are from Transylvania. They have hypnotic powers. They can cast spells. They can shapeshift into things that are other than werewolves. They can only be killed with a stake through the heart. Are you starting to see a pattern here, how this doesn't jive with werewolves? And holy water affects them, which has never affected werewolves. I mean, there's no way that this was not a vampire script where they did Microsoft Word replace for vampire to werewolf. Well, number 2 also retcons the ending of the first film really, really poorly.
Retcon?
Retro continuity.
You want to explain that for us non-super nerds?
Okay, basically at the end of the first film, Karen transforms into a werewolf on live television and is put down. And you see the reactions from all over the area that, yes, this is happening, this is being seen. All of a sudden in the second film, Christopher Lee says it was never broadcast and he's got the bootleg tape and the TV station's trying to keep it under wraps, which completely contradicts the last 5 minutes of the first film, doesn't it?
When I was growing up in Bakersfield, my favorite thing in all the world was to go to the movies on Saturday afternoons for the chapter plays. My favorite was Rocket Man, and once it was a No Brakes chapter. The bad guy stuck him in a car on a mountain road, knocked him out, and welded the door shut and tore out the brakes and started him to his death. And he woke up and tried to steer and tried to get out, but the car went off a cliff before he could escape. And it crashed and burned, and I was so upset and excited. And the next week, you better believe I was first in line. And they always start with the end of the last week. And there was Rocket Man trying to get out. And here comes the cliff. And just before the car went off the cliff, he jumped free. And all the kids cheered. But I didn't cheer. I stood right up and started shouting, "This isn't what happened last week! Have you all got amnesia? They just cheated us! This isn't fair! He didn't get out of the cock-a-doody car!"
Rob, your thoughts on 2?
Haven't seen it.
Rob avoided all these sequels like the plague.
That's why I apologize to Mike for making him watch them all.
All right, number 3.
Nowadays, the shifting to Australia kind of comes across as a joke, but at the time, that was the big thing in film.
I saw clips of this in Not Quite Hollywood, and I was like, what the hell is going on here? Because it's, you know, Howling 3, the marsupials, and it's like, what? Who came up with that?
And they actually try to link it back to the continuity of the second film by mentioning it in one line of dialogue that as some previous event that would substantiate scientist guy's theory. So they kind of try to tie it together. I always thought the chick that played Jerba was hot as hell. Even with the pouch and the fuzzy belly, I'm still willing to overlook that because she was hot as hell. And again, this ending has her transforming into a werewolf on live television. Do any of the other films bring this up? No, they don't. Why do you keep using that ending if you don't want to put that in continuity? I don't get that.
He didn't get out of the cock-a-doody car!
Well, then 4 just kind of breaks with the previous 3 and says, here we go, we're starting again.
In a boring, boring manner.
Boring, boring manner. And so we kind of covered this because it's the one that is closest to the original. Though all of the stuff that I found interesting about, and by original I mean the book, all the stuff I found interesting about the book, they managed to kind of screw up. And we'll be hearing a little bit later from Gary Bradner to talk about his books and how this adaptation came about and why every single movie, I think from there on out, it might have been 3 from there on out, was like, you know, based upon The Howling 1, 2, and 3. Which really doesn't make any sense because they're not, you know, like that one could say based upon The Howling book 1, but nothing else really was based upon that. Maybe based upon characters created by or something, but yeah, he managed somehow contractually to get that into those credits, which is kind of a disservice to him, but maybe he sold some more books that way. So let's jump over to 5, which was Howling 5, The Rebirth. That was 1989. So we're 8 years away from the original, and we've already pretty much, you know, we've thrown the original completely away. And that's the one that takes place at the castle. And as you said, it's very 10 Little Indians. And it starts off in the past. And I thought, okay, cool. We're going to get some good stuff going on here. And then they go to the present, you know, the 1989 present. And it's just a bunch of yahoos at this castle that I really didn't give any kind of a hoot about.
And you could tell the budgets were starting to suffer at this point, even more than 4's, as 5 and 6 were shot in Romania. You can tell that this is shot in Romania. You can tell that this is Eastern Europe in the late 80s.
This was the hardest part of doing a marathon of Howling movies, because between 4 and 5, it was such a slog to get through those two. I mean, 5 could have maybe been interesting, but it just wasn't. Because like I said, I didn't care about the characters whatsoever.
And then 6, now you got to remember, when I saw 6 for the first time, I had just skipped school that day and the video store was on the way home. So I'm already, you know, feeling elated because I'm supposed to be in school and I'm not. And I'm going, oh, my God, a vampire? They finally threw a vampire into a Howling movie? How awesome is this? Mike, I think you can attest to how not awesome that was.
It was. Well, other than the appearance of Antonio Fargas and Deep Roy, had it been a movie about those guys, cool. But the main guy, what is it? Is it Brendan Hughes was the main guy? Or I can't even remember who played the main character, but it was like he was so not awesome. And the guy who played our werewolf in that was just like, why are you wasting my time?
That was a bad, bad one. And then New Moon Rising is frankly a joke, even by the writer, director, producer, star of it. He even kind of looks at it as, yeah, I was clearly high, even though I wasn't.
7, I have to say, almost short-circuited my brain. It was absolutely hilariously bizarre. Just, it's like 7, for folks who don't know, it all takes place in this little town, again, the little town. And we've got this Australian dude who kind of comes to town. And so that kind of plays into, you know, part 3 a little bit, which all took place in Australia. And I swear the cast of this film is basically the populace of the town where they shot it. It
It is. You're not wrong at all.
God.
The main actor, who's also the writer, director, and producer, he's the only actor that was brought in. Everyone else is an actual townsfolk.
No wonder it feels like community theater. I mean, everybody kind of tripping over their own lines and, oh, just the corny jokes and stuff. Oh, my God. It's like this whole discussion where they're like making jokes about like body parts that are falling apart and just really bad. And then rather than showing any kind of werewolf at all, they just show clips from the previous 3 movies. So you get clips from 4, 5, and 6 throughout 7, and they're kind of trying to tie those 3 together in 7, even though they're vastly different. Like 4 was the retelling of Brandner's novel. 5 took place at this castle, which was very, you know, kind of kicking it old school, even though it was, you know, like modern times and all these people kind of coming back to this castle. And then 6 was the circus sideshow, but yet they took all these 3 things and tried to meld them into 1 and then shot them into 7. Where, yeah, oh, I'm so glad to know that that wasn't some sort of professional cast, because they were just, it was ridiculously awful the way that they were trying to deliver these lines. But yet, I enjoyed that one more than I enjoyed the previous 2, 5 and 6, maybe even 4, because I was so bored by 4. And 7 was just such a car crash that I was kind of fascinated by it. My head was just spinning watching this thing.
Rob's going to need to check out 7 if for no other reason than that.
And then 16 years after New Moon Rising, they decided to do a reboot, calling it The Howling Reborn. And this one I just got done watching today for the first time. I'm pretty much gobsmacked. I really couldn't believe what I was seeing. And in fact, there were a lot of times where I had to actually back up the movie because there were so many gaps in the film. Like, wait, how did that guy get there? What happened to this? Somebody pushed that one guy down the stairs and everybody is still in high school. Isn't somebody going to find that corpse? It all takes place at a high school. Almost all of it takes place on the night of graduation. And we've got this guy, I think his name is Edward Cullen, and this girl named Bella. And is she a werewolf? Maybe not. No. Is he a werewolf? Well, we can't really be sure. Oh, wait. No, he's going to turn into a werewolf. And they're these kind of star-crossed lovers. And she's got this asshole boyfriend. And he's got this, you know, filmmaker friend who's has all these great one-liners about vampires that sparkle and yada, yada, yada. And he's got a mom that, you know, is missing, and she's got a dad who's been missing from her life, and they get together and they almost have sex in a library, which is kind of unadvisable, I have to say, kids, especially during the middle of day on the last day of school. I still don't think you want to have sex in the library, even though there's no one else around. Yeah, just horrible, horrible stuff, just huge gaps in the film, and I'm just like, what is happening here? And then the acting is bad, and just
it's shot with that washed out camera to give it that Twilight look.
Yeah, and everyone is pale. I mean, and the main guy does look a lot like Edward Cullen. And I have to say that the only part of the whole movie that I liked was the main character's mom, who had a smoking rack and just was really looking good. And so I was, and it kind of turned me on when she got all deep throaty and was starting to, you know, turn into a werewolf and stuff. I was like, yeah, this is going to get good. But then even the effects and everything, I mean, all the werewolves were shot with like these, you know, maybe 6-frame kind of a shot where it's like, what the hell just happened? What am I looking at? And it was all confuso vision. So you never really saw a werewolf. And then when you did, it looked like you were looking at Batman or something because the ears are sticking straight up. And it's like, people paid money to see this thing. Thank God it's on Netflix streaming because, oh, it is horrible.
It's Howling for the Twilight Generation. And that's a sad statement, I think.
Yeah, the whole idea of calling it Howling Reborn, this shouldn't have been called The Howling at all.
You should retitle it instead of Reborn. It should be The Howling the Abortion. How about that?
From Howling Afterbirth.
There you go.
Howling the Afterbirth. This franchise really does not have a good set of credentials to it. I remember back in, I don't even think the 7th film had come out yet, like early 90s, Gore Zone, back when that magazine still came out, did a big like 10-page retrospective of the Howling franchise, and they called it How This Franchise Went Wrong. So even back then, people could see this franchise is a joke, and it's become even more of a joke in the internet era, I think.
Which is a shame because the first movie is remarkably good. That really does stand up. I had a good time watching this. It was something that I could watch with the missus, and there was no like, why are you watching this film? Because there was a good level of humor and there was a good level of horror. And yeah, it's not gross for gross sake. And heck yeah, seeing all these great actors in here. I mean, you know, all kidding aside, I am a huge Robert Picardo fan, so it was great to see him. I mean, pretty much whenever you see effects by Rob Bottin, you know that you're going to get Picardo in there someplace. So it's always good to see him show up in things.
Okay, we're going to take a break and play back a few interviews. The first one was with writer of the Howling books, Gary Bradner, and second, the director of the original Howling, not all those sequels, Mr. Joe Dante.
Hi there, I'm a Gumbo, and I'm with the Traumatic Cinematic Show. We're a podcast that talks about films. Yeah, we'd like to invite you to come listen to our show. You can find us at traumaticcinematic.com. You can also find us on Twitter at DC Podcast Crew. Also, you should come over and check out our Podomatic page, traumaticcinematic.podomatic.com. We're also on Facebook, so you can come on out there and find us too. I'm on the internet.
I'm Dangerous Jamie. Joining me as always is Sarah, and we're going to talk to you about why you should be listening to the Gold Press Broadcast.
Let's do that.
Let's indeed. Why should they be listening to the Gold Press Broadcast?
Well, firstly, because it's awesome, obviously.
Obviously. I mean, that's a given, or a given.
A given, yeah. You can expect nonsensical puns like that.
Yeah. With zero context.
Absolutely zero context.
But also, we review horror films.
Mostly, we review horror films, I would say.
Well, yeah, that's probably the bulk of what we do.
Yep.
We also look at new releases, top five lists.
Yep.
We cover theme months.
Yeah, we do some horror news.
Yeah, tell us about the theme months that we covered.
We have done Horror Behind Bars.
Yeah, we did Clown Town, where we looked at clown movies.
We did. We've done Trash Kings.
Trash Kings, where we looked at the films of Fred Olen Ray, Jim Wynorski and David Zuccotto.
Yeah, we've done a bunch of stuff. We've got Revenge Month in the works, Trauma Month. So yeah, loads of stuff like that.
Loads of stuff. So if you like horror films, you should probably listen to the Gold Press Scorecast.
Absolutely.
We're here and we're ready to believe you. So that's not all you can get. You can also get extra super bonus content when you subscribe to the feed. Tell about it, Sarah. Tell them now.
We do the Gore Press Gormentry, which is basically us shamelessly ripping off Mystery Science Theatre. Yeah, basically getting drunk, chatting over the top of a film, and hopefully being quite entertaining, I think.
There are two ways to find the show. You can find us over at iTunes by searching for the new Gore Press Gorecast.
You can indeed.
Or you can go to gorepress.com and read all the great reviews, news, interviews and everything, all there alongside the podcast.
Yeah.
So come on, subscribe to the new Gore Press Gorecast. Tune in, drop out, stay spooky.
Wow.
I'd recommend this show to anybody. Anybody who's into smut.
Everyone wants to spice things up in the bedroom. Here's an offer you won't want to miss. Listeners of the Projection Booth podcast can enjoy 50% off just about any one item at adamandeve.com when you use the promotion code BOOTH. You also get free shipping and 3 free adult DVDs. Once again, that promotional code is BOOTH. That's B-O-O-T-H. Visit adamandeve.com today.
Gary, how did you get in the writing game?
Oh, I've always done some kind of writing, Mike. Even in grade school, I used to write a scandal sheet about my little classmates. Went on through technical writing, advertising writing. Got laid off when aerospace died. Thought I'd try fiction writing, and there I've been ever since.
And you've written, gosh, like well over 24 books, right?
Yeah, about 30 books and maybe 100 short stories.
What was your first foray into it? What was your first novel?
The first book I wrote novel length was called Saturday Night in Milwaukee. Is that intriguing? Boy, I did that in collaboration with a friend, Clayton Matthews, and he let me put my name on it. There it is today, a classic. The first one I really wrote all on my own, I guess, would be The Players, a tennis novel I did in 1975.
When was The Howling? That was, what, 78?
The Howling, that was 77, yeah.
And how did you come up with the idea for that one?
I've been thinking of a werewolf story for a long time, and my agent wasn't enthusiastic, so I went ahead and wrote the whole book rather than just the usual outline and sample chapter. Sent it to him, and he said, Gary, I wish you'd ask me before you did this. I won't be able to place this anywhere. But a couple of weeks later, it sold to Fawcett.
And how was it received?
Very well, yeah. It had a nice dump in the bookstore right by the cash register, so it became a paperback bestseller.
When did it get optioned?
I'm not sure, but a Hollywood agent called up and told me he had an option for that and Howling 2, and said it was $50,000. I said, wow, $15,000? And she said, no, $50,000. Boy, I don't know. It was a couple of years later. I about fell out of my chair.
How did you decide to come up with the sequel?
My British publisher asked for one. I hadn't planned to write a sequel, but the British publisher of The Howling said, how about a sequel of that? And heck, I'm amenable, so I cranked out a sequel.
Now, had you done a sequel to your own work before?
No.
What was the process like for you? I mean, I imagine you probably felt like you'd kind of put these characters to bed. What was it like to kind of take them out and use them again?
Yeah, you're right. I had killed off my favorite character in Howling. It was Marcia. And I brought her back to life through a little literary license and made her the sort of the main character in Howling 2. Especially like Elizabeth Brooks, who played the part in the movie. Late Elizabeth Brooks, I guess. But I thought she was terrific.
Did they ask you at all to write the screenplay? Had you had any Hollywood experience at that time?
No. No requests, no invitations, nothing for that first screenplay or the whole movie. Although, I gotta say, it was a pretty good movie, and it gave me an annuity. But no, I had nothing to do with it.
The third Howling book, that was quite a few years later, right? At least another five or six?
That was, 1985, Howling 3.
And how did that one come about?
I don't honestly remember. Probably because the first two were selling well. My agent probably came up with the idea. It was great idea or the suggestion. Got no great sexy story about that.
I like that, how that kind of ran like a side story to the original.
Yeah, I didn't pick up and it wasn't an actual sequel. I got a new character and gave it sort of a young man coming of age theme.
I know that Howling 4 was kind of more of a direct adaptation, though they definitely took liberties when it came to that one, of the first book. How do you think that those kind of compare?
I don't think much of any of the Roman numeral movies, even though I did do a screenplay for two. But no, they cranked them out with, I don't know, some were pretty bad. But I collected a check for each one, so as for the base stock credit. So I can't complain. And Philippe Mora, the director who did several of them, worked under great handicaps, and they wouldn't give him much money, so he had to do what he could with what he had.
So what was your story like for two? What was the screenplay like?
Quite a bit different from what it came out. I kept getting notes, as we say in Hollywood. I wrote the screenplay, took it out, and there was a bunch of producers and money people sitting around a pool. We took the meeting, very Hollywood-like, at a pool. And they said, "Boy, Gary, we love this. This is great, wonderful story. But just one thing, the big money now is coming in from Spain, and they'd like it to take place in Spain. Can you do that?" And I said, "Sure." Gathered up my script, went home, rewrote it, came back with the main action in Spain, and they said, "Hey, this is great. We love it. Wonderful. You did a good job. Thing is, Spanish money dropped out, so we're shooting it in Yugoslavia. And you make some changes?" And I said, "Well, I guess so." So I went home and came back, and they said, "Just one thing. The main money man wants a part for a friend of his, Fernando Rey, yes." And I had no Fernando Rey in there. So I said, "Okay, I can't do it this time. I have a book contract." So they hired out another screenwriter, and he did the necessary rewrite, they thought, and I was out of the screenplay.
The movie that was actually made really kind of reminds me of a vampire movie where they just kind of substituted werewolves inside of it.
That could be. One thing that happened to Philippe Mora in that movie, he sent a book to Universal, to the costume outfit, asking for, "Send me werewolf costumes, gotta have werewolf costumes." And what they sent him was from Planet of the Apes. So he had to somehow make the monkey suits apparently werewolf. But anyway, the final product I didn't have much to do with. I wrote initial screenplay, and most of it disappeared.
So have you watched all of the sequels and the reboot, the New Moon, or not New Moon Rising, what was it, Reborn?
Mike, I watch those just until my credit comes on the screen. That's the truth. I just can't look at them. I can't look at them.
Now, you've had other books of yours turned into films. How's that experience been?
Yeah, a couple of them. Cameron's Closet, that one I did the screenplay for, and I thought it wasn't too bad a movie. The one change the movie the producer made in this, in the opening, I had Cameron, he's a little boy, 10-year-old boy, had his brother accidentally killed while Cameron couldn't get to him, and this was what was going to psychologically scar Cameron. Producer said, we can't kill a kid in here, so by sort of even things up, he let me decapitate Tab Hunter, and that was it. Tab Hunter was written into the script, got to decapitate him. It was not as much fun as my original idea. Okay, what are you going to do?
How was the experience with having Walkers turn into a movie?
Yeah, that was the NBC two-parter. I didn't have anything to do with that. They had changed the title to kind of a generic From the Dead of Night. And there was some kind of a series called The Walkers or something, and they didn't want to get confused. It wasn't a bad thing. It was a two-part movie, and I didn't have anything to do with the screenplay of that. Watched it and kind of liked it.
What have you been up to lately? What are you working on now?
I'm sort of toying with another Howling. Number 4. But beyond that, I can't say, because Hemingway used to say, if you talk about it, it goes away.
How did you get into movies? Like, what was your background?
I actually wanted to be a cartoonist. When I went to Philadelphia College of Art, and it was essentially art school, but after the first year, they informed me that cartooning wasn't an art, and I better take something else. And so they did have a fledgling film course with, you know, like 30 students and 2 cameras. It was very low tech, and I sort of got into doing that. But that really wasn't the instigation. It was because I was I had seen so many movies, and I was writing about movies. I got a job after college, trade magazine, reviewing movies, and then some friends of mine came out here to work for Roger Corman, and I sort of had thought maybe I might want to do something in the film business, but I didn't know what. So I came out here and started editing trailers, and after a couple of years of doing trailers, or actually during the first year of doing trailers, I got an opportunity to co-direct a very low-budget feature. And I thought, okay, this will be interesting to see if this is something that I like doing. And I found out that I did like doing it, that I actually had a facility for it, mainly because I'd seen so many movies, and the shots came easily. So then it's sort of like, well, I guess that's what I'm going to do.
How did you meet John Davison?
John introduced himself to me in my crappy apartment in Philadelphia when I was in college. He was only in high school, and he had read my writing in Castle of Frankenstein magazine, and he invited me to a science fiction convention. And he was the first person to come out here that I knew that, you know, worked Corman, and then since Roger had pretty much dried up the pool of talent here in L.A., he was importing people from New York. And so I just took a flyer and came out here thinking, well, you know, either this is going to work out or it's not.
Can you tell me a little bit about the movie Orgy? How did that even come about? How did you get access to all the clips that you put together?
Well, John was already collecting 16mm films, and he's got me into it, too. And there had been, in 1966 or 67, there was a reissue of the Batman serial from 1943. They sort of cash in on the TV show, and it was to run all in one night, all 12 chapters, and it became kind of a sit-in where people would stay there and they would watch the chapters end, and they would see how they cheated at the beginning of the next chapter, and basically, it was kind of an endurance test, and you'd go out for pizza and come back, and you hadn't missed any. And it was very collegial and lots of fun. Everybody had a good time, so we could do that. We have serials. We can throw something together. So we ran a Bela Lugosi serial called The Phantom Creeps at Philadelphia College of Art and interspersed it with a lot of clips and stuff from these libraries that were going out of business and had given us all these missing pieces and commercials and all sorts of weird stuff, cartoons. It evolved ultimately into the Movie Orgy, which we ran at NYU, I think, for the first time. And we had then gotten into the idea of we could run 5 or more feature films by renting them, running the beginnings, and then when they got boring, cutting to our other reel of stuff that we had, and then zipping down into the reel and get into the next interesting part of the movie, and then putting on a reel from another movie. And so by the time the show was over, which ran about 7 hours, we had gone through sort of 25-minute cutdowns of five different pictures along with all of our other nonsense that we were running. And we would switch out the pictures, and it would become a different show.
Do you still collect films?
There's really not much point in collecting films because they don't make projectors anymore. So we still have our 16-millimeter collection, and of course it's a much better storage retrieval form than digital, which nobody really knows. You can't really, you know, save anything on digital because it doesn't last. But nobody runs 16-millimeter anymore. Frankly, the material you get if you get a Blu-ray is much closer to the original negative and has better sound than your 16-millimeter print. Usually is uncut, because almost all the 16 prints were from TV stations, and they have cue marks on them and lots of splices. So more often than not, I find myself running digital, although there's a lot of pictures that we have that I don't think will ever come out on commercial DVDs, and so we still save them. But you find that it really is, it's pretty much gone with the wind, that form of film collecting.
What's kind of your holy grail? What's the one that you hold on to?
Well, we used to have a great print of Stairway to Heaven, which is the Michael Powell movie with David Niven, which is also known as A Matter of Life and Death, but that was a Kodachrome print, and then we eventually got a Technicolor print of the other version. And of course, the original version is longer because it wasn't censored, so that's a pretty good one. And we've got a lot of B pictures that I just haven't seen the light of day very many places, and so we're hanging on to them.
How did you and John Sayles meet?
Well, John and I met because of Piranha. I was assigned to do Piranha from a script that, frankly, wasn't very good, and I suggested that maybe we needed a new writer. And Roger Corman's assistant, Frances Stoll, was part of her job was to check out all the new young writers. And she had just read a novel that John had written and suggested that maybe he might be a good person to rewrite Piranha. And so he came out here, and we had a meeting, and he came up with some pretty good ideas that were a lot better than what was in the script. And he went off and wrote Piranha, and that was his first screenplay.
I know you were supposed to be working on Jaws 3 People Zero. How did that project kind of come about? And then,
well, because I did Piranha, I was getting offered all the aquatic monster movies, Orca 2, Alligator, you know, movies that required you to go underwater and wear a wetsuit, which is the last thing in the world I ever wanted to do again. And one of the offers was for Jaws 3 People Zero, which at the time was a co-production between Universal and National Lampoon, and who had just made Animal House. And so they were pretty hot stuff, but there was a lot of disagreement between them and the producers, Zanuck and Brown, as to what kind of a movie it should be. They wanted to do a raunchy comedy, and Zanuck and Brown wanted to do something that would be PG-rated. And so there was a lot of tension as to what kind of a movie it was going to be. And here I was, the kid hired from Corman, who basically was given his storyboards and said, here's your picture, go make it. And as it happened, it managed to fall apart just around the time the Howling was being done. And so I managed to segue directly from the unmade Jaws 3 People Zero into the soon-to-be-made Howling.
So where was that project at the time?
That was at AFCO Embassy, which was a small distributor that was currently had a lot of success with horror pictures like Scanners and Prom Night.
And was it just kind of in its idea form, or had they already?
No, there was another director on it who left, and he left his screenplay behind, which once again was very problematic and required the services of John Sayles to come in and punch it up and fix it and make it makeable.
What was that original script like? Was it closer to the novel, or was it?
It was much closer to the novel, and the novel, of course, is, you know, it was the kind of novel where people live in this ramshackle, abandoned village that just happens to be on a main highway. The novel read fine as a sort of a fun read, but when you actually tried to visualize it, it just didn't really make much sense. And so we switched it all around and, you know, turned it into something a little different.
Yeah, I've read the screenplay, and there's a lot of differences between the screenplay and the finished film. Was that kind of more budgetary stuff?
Well, that's often the case. You know, sometimes things work on the page that don't work on the stage, and then there's other times where you just can't afford to do things, or a scene like, you know, Eddie Clift stands against the wall and turns into a werewolf. That's only one sentence on a page, becomes 5 minutes in the movie. So there's a lot of scenes in the movie that are sort of elaborated on from the things in the script. And there's other things that just got shot and cut out.
The Howling was one of three pretty major werewolf films in 81. What was in the air at that point?
I don't know. There wasn't just three. There was also Full Moon High, which is, you know, Larry Cohen's movie. And then there was Teen Wolf and The Wolfen and American Werewolf. Around the time Splash was being made, there was a competing mermaid movie as well. I mean, sometimes these things just come in chunks, but 1981 was indeed the year of the werewolf.
You know, one of the best things about your work to me is the way that you mix different genres. In this case, horror with a little bit of comedy in there. And was that kind of always your goal, or just that's how it happened?
I don't know that it was my goal, but my influences were people like James Whale and people who always had a comic edge to the material on screen, no matter how horrific it was. And also because by 1981, 1978, people were kind of jaded with these kind of movies, and they were going to find places to laugh if you didn't give them some. And so I find that because the emotions of laughter and fear are somewhat interrelated, that it's great to be able to give somebody something to relax them before you hit them with a scare. Because once you hit them with the scare, they're going to laugh again anyway, just out of sheer nervous laughter. It's part of my, I guess, my absurdist worldview. I think when you're asking the audience to believe in something that essentially impossible, I think you have to do it with a little humor.
How did you and Rob Bottin hook up?
Rob worked on Piranha as a 17-year-old. He was Rick Baker's protege at the time. Even then, he was brilliant. And in order to get him to do Piranha, we offered to let him direct a scene from the movie. But we said, we can't give you any sound because we need it for the main unit. But and your friend can go off and shoot a piranha attack. And so he and his then-girlfriend went off and played deaf mutes doing sign language. And they got eaten by the piranhas. And, of course, he sculpted a head of himself having been eaten, which is the only thing that remains in the movie of that sequence, is his bobbing head, which comes up half-eaten in a big close-up, and that's actually Rob Bottin's head.
Are he and Robert Picardo kind of like a package deal? Like if you get
no,
one,
not really,
you get
but
the other?
But Bob was, when it came time to do The Howling, it was going to be obvious that the makeup was going to be quite arduous. It was very difficult to find actors who would sit still for that amount of time, because Rob was nothing if not a perfectionist, and in fact, one day he took so much time putting makeup on Bob that we had to send everybody home because we were in overtime already, hadn't shot anything. But Bob had an ability to take it, you know, to be able to wear this pounds of rubber and not only, you know, enhance it with his performance, but, you know, not get testy and not want to have his contact lenses taken out every 5 minutes. And, I mean, he was just an ideal subject. And when you look at some of his other work, like the costume he wore in Explorers, which was incredibly heavy and painful and wet. And then the character he plays in Legend, you know, I mean, it was sort of like, well, if you, Bob Picardo is your go-to guy if you want to cover somebody up with latex.
How did the rest of the casting come about? How did Dee Wallace get chosen?
Dee, I had seen in 10, and I thought she was really good. And she was also a friend of the casting director, Susan Arnold, who was Jack Arnold's daughter. She got the part and did her then-boyfriend, Chris Stone, to play the guy. And Patrick Nee was an idea that I had had ever since I read the script. I thought this was a perfect part for him. And luckily he did too. And we filled out the rest of the cast with people who, you know, were blown from, you know, there was a thing then called TVQ, where if you cast people who were recognizable to TV audiences, you could make a network sale more easily. And so a lot of pictures in those days have, like, you know, one day from Keenan Wynn or 3 days work from John Carradine or something like that, where just to get, you know, recognizable people into the movies.
Now, was this your first foray with Kevin McCarthy, or had you done stuff before?
Piranha was my first foray with Kevin. We originally hired Eric Braeden to play that part, and when he came down to the swimming pool and saw how amateur our setup was, he dutifully went through the motions of shooting what he had to shoot, and then he called me up that night and he said, "I'm sorry, I can't do this." And so we obviously, if he didn't want to do it, we didn't want him to do it. And so we offered it to Kevin. And Kevin apparently took a couple of hours to wander around Central Park deciding whether or not he wanted to make this low-budget horror picture. And I was always glad that he said yes.
What was it like to work with him?
Oh, Kevin was great. He was a wonderful actor. And he was when I first met him, he was very method. And there's a scene where he has to fight with Bradford Dolman, and he almost killed him. He was so proud. Kevin, stop, you know, because he really would get into the scenes. I mean, I hardly knew Kevin personally when I'm directing his first scene. And he's standing in the corner, and we're just about to shoot this fight scene. And he's pepping himself up by saying, "It's the end of the fucking world. It's the end of the fucking world." And I thought, wow, boy. Because, you know, when you start making movies the way I did, you don't really have a lot of contact with actors until you actually just get to the set and meet them. You know, so it's not like you get to talk about their backstory or, you know, how they want to play the part. It's just you just show up and do it. It's a low-budget movie. And so I learned a tremendous amount from Kevin and from Brad, who was a godsend on that movie because he was so professional. And he would always match everything in ways that I was too busy to pay attention to. And we certainly didn't have any real script supervising going on. But he was just letter perfect all the time.
What was it like to work with Slim Pickens?
Slim was great. I mean, he only was on the picture for a couple of days. And I developed a habit of doing the slates myself so that these guys could tell me stories while everybody was setting the lights. And so he or Carradine would start to tell me a story, and then it would be time to shoot, and I'd say, "Now hold that story." And I'd do the slates, and we'd do the scene, and then I'd say, "We need take two." And then I'd go back and hear the rest of the story before the next slate.
Being such a big film fan growing up, and then working with these guys who you had admired, you know, seeing their films.
It was wonderful. I mean, it was a dream come true. You could hardly believe you were doing it. And they were all so receptive and nice, and they, you know, they're no heirs. I mean, these are professional people. They were there to do the job, and that's what they did. They liked it. And it was great to be around them.
Was there ever a point where you reached and you said, "I'm not necessarily that big of a fan anymore. Now I'm a director"?
No, not really. No, I don't think so. And I've also never met, none of those people disappointed me. I mean, I never met one of them that turned out to be an asshole.
Oh, that's great. How did you and Dick Miller meet?
Dick and I, of course, I had seen Dick many times on the screen. And when John Davison came out here to work for Roger, I think one of the first things he did was make sure that Dick was rehired for various movies that were being made at the time. And Jonathan Kaplan, another friend of mine, was directing, and he put Dick in a couple of pictures. And then when I came out here, I felt it was only my turn. It's my turn to put Dick in a picture. And so when I got to do my first movie, I met him on the set the first day. He came in playing this sleazy, and we hit it off, and I put him in every picture that I could squeeze him into after that. You know, it's fun to watch old movies, and like all of a sudden, here he is selling guns to Arnold Schwarzenegger. You know?
With The Howling, it seems like, you know, listening to the audio commentary, it seems like it was a fairly difficult shoot, but it also sounds like you guys had a lot of fun doing it.
Well, we had as much fun as we could have. I mean, the problem is that these movies are made so fast that you really don't have time to think. And one thing that helps is if everybody's copacetic on the set and everybody gets along and everybody's making the same movie, and nobody's afraid to make suggestions or to, you know, speak out and suggest a different way of doing things. I mean, that's where the fun comes. That's where I discovered the difference between sitting in an editing room and being alone and being on a movie set where you're constantly bombarded with people's ideas and personalities. I didn't know that would be something I liked because I was kind of an introvert. But I found that it was something that I responded to, and that's the most fun about making movies is working with the actors and the crew.
So they've made 7 sequels plus like a remake or however you
whatever
want to count
you want to call it. Yes.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I never get a dime because I wasn't in the DGA at the time.
Oh, that sucks. Did they approach you for Howling 2, or were you just on a completely different path by then?
I can't remember what year that was, but it seems to me that I was probably doing the Twilight Zone movie. Mm-hmm. Pretty baby.
We're back. Thanks again to Gary Brandner and Joe Dante. We'll hear more from Mr. Dante in a few weeks when we cover Gremlins. Now let's get back into The Howling.
we had talked before about the way that Dante kind of mixes humor and horror, and I don't know, that's kind of like, would you guys consider that like his staple? Is that his strong suit? Because to me, it's like the way that Gremlins plays out, the way that, I guess, Explorers is more of a family-friendly kind of thing, but the way that even Small Soldiers, there's some weird stuff, and it's a fairly intense family film, the way that that plays out. I mean, where do you guys put Joe Dante in your pantheon of directors? Rob, how about you?
I think Joe Dante is one of these guys who seems to slip in and out of pop culture. I mean, with something like Gremlins and things like that, I mean, obviously he has known commodities. People go, oh yeah, I've seen that, even if they're not film fans. And I think that his stuff kind of rides this borderline between mainstream fare and then really loving sort of his Corman B movie roots, William Castle, that kind of stuff. I mean, just that, I really like that mix. I like that he puts humor in with the horror, because it seems like nowadays we get horror films that are like grueling and not so much funny in the same sort of style in which him and Sayles did, like Piranha and did The Howling.
I think Dante has a very deft hand when it comes to the balancing act that is horror and humor. That is something that's been tried by a lot of people, and there are very few movies that can balance the horror and the humor and make them both work, where when you need a scare, you get the scare, but then also when you're supposed to laugh, you laugh. I think Dante is one of those few filmmakers that can pull that off properly. Another that was pretty good at that was Dan O'Bannon, but he unfortunately didn't make all that many movies. But the few he did, he was able to pull that off as well. I think Toby Hooper is another one that's able to do that when he tries to.
Landis definitely can do it when he needs to as well. I mean, as far as American Werewolf in London, but then it's like, what else has Landis made where he kind of injects that horror in there?
The Masters of Horror episodes. The episode Dear Woman is pretty good. And by the way, it's an official sequel to American Werewolf. They mention a werewolf running through Piccadilly Circus in 1981 as part of the backstory of the Dear Woman character. So it is an official sequel to American Werewolf. It's still better than London. And see, that I think is part of the reason that The Howling, while doing well, didn't do as well as it should have. It was stuck in a glut of werewolf movies. All of a sudden, every producer, every company decided in 1980-81, let's make a werewolf movie. And I think this got lost in the glut.
You know, the same thing happened to Deep Impact. You know, that Armageddon came out, and Deep Impact, just nobody paid attention to it.
Nobody should have. Tay Leone's horrible.
And plus, it's totally unrealistic. I mean, a black president, come on.
Yeah, really. You know you're talking science fiction then.
With The Howling, the first film initially, I think it wasn't regarded the way it should have been. I think the sequels actually did do damage to it. You know how normally there's that philosophy that if you like the first film, a bad sequel is not going to ruin your enjoyment of it. In general, I can give you that. But there are certain films and certain franchises where the sequels do ruin it. The Alien franchise, the Predator franchise, and the Howling franchise are all wrecked by their later terrible sequels, I think.
Okay, let's pull one out of the sequel bin here. That's all those, you know, Friday the 13th movies. I mean, the first couple are okay, and then I could care less until you get to the Freddy Jason one, which is just ridiculous.
No way. Part 6, Jason Lives, is the best in the whole franchise. I'm not being facetious on that. I love Friday the 13th, Part 6.
Really?
I liked when he was in space myself.
Jason X was way better than it had any right to be.
Okay, moving on.
Sorry, Rob.
Now, leaving the quality aside, because I think the other two movies, American Werewolf in London and Wolfen, let's leave Full Moon High out right now because that was so low budget, no one ever saw that. But American Werewolf in London and Wolfen, both being quality films, the same as The Howling, do you think people just got werewolfed out in 81?
Well, just put it this way. I mean, between Mike and I, we didn't know what the hell movie we were even talking about. I'm watching The Howling and going, is this the right movie? Or did I mean Wolfen? And then I was like, oh, no, this is the right movie. So it's like even I got confused between which one we were supposed to fucking watch.
Rob goes, yeah, I want to do The Howling. And I was like, oh, man, that movie kind of grossed me out when I was a kid. There's that scene at the beginning, and, like, there's that dog, and I'm just, like, going on and on.
And there's Gregory Hines.
And I watched the movie, and I was just like, where the hell was all that stuff? What am I thinking of? So, yeah, in the middle of this marathon of Howling movies, I watched Wolfen, and I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah, well, I mean, to me, the only thing I remembered, because it had been so long since I seen it, was the very end where she's in the bar ordering the hamburger and this bloody hamburger is grilling. That's the only thing I could remember, and I didn't know which movie it was in.
She asked for that burger rare, so they totally effed that up because that is not a rare burger.
Well, and then you also have that brilliant line. I remember this from all the TV showings of, what are you kids watching? Newswoman's turning into a werewolf. Okay, just don't sit too close to the TV.
And I love, like, talking about some of the lines. I mean, I love one of the lines that made me laugh my ass off was, hey, not all of us have the money for a Mazda. Some of us have to work for a living.
I wasn't even sure when I watched that one if it was real or not. I was like, wait, was that supposed to be a joke or no? How have things changed since 1981?
Well, and then I also like some of the editing that they do as jokes in the original. Like right as he's like, cut away, and they cut away from what they're seeing to like a dog, really sloppy, wet dog food being poured into a bowl. And you're like, yeah, that was as unappealing as you can get.
Well, for me, it was all about the in-jokes with the names and stuff. Like when they started, you know, listing off character names, I was like, oh, that's too good. You know, Freddie Francis and Terry Fisher and all this. It's like, okay, I see what you're doing there. That's very nice.
Well, and then even little in-jokes, such as in Patrick McNee's office, he's got a painting of the Howl.
Yeah, and what was that, like Howling Chili or something? I'm trying to remember what that was.
He also had some like poetry book, like Howling at the Concrete Moon or something, on his desk. There was all these little howling and werewolf jokes scattered throughout the movie that not even all of us film nerds are probably going to pick up on.
Yeah, Tom Wolfe. Somebody was reading Tom Wolfe. It was like, oh, nice.
And you know what's really funny? Since this movie was a UHF staple, do you know what scene got edited the most while still being left in? The porno shop at the beginning.
Oh, of
course. Try to watch it on TV. It's just all blur blobs, and just the actors are unblur blobbed, and that's about it. You almost, it's like she's walking through fog. Because you cannot cut those scenes, but you can't have those boxes in the background either.
This is a really foggy store. I've never been in a store this foggy before.
That's what the red light is for behind the counter.
To make sure that ships don't crash into it.
Yes, it's like the lighthouse. We're now crossing into John Carpenter territory here with the fog.
Iceberg, right ahead! Well, Rob Bottin did the werewolf effects in here, and he would go on to do a lot of great stuff. Like we talked about with Dante and John Sayles. I mean, Bottin probably was the man for 20 years after this in terms of all the various things he did. I know he did Fight Club. He worked on RoboCop. So, I mean, here's a guy whose special effects work. I mean, I think he'd been doing a little bit before this, but it was nothing compared to what would come up in the next decade or two ahead.
John Carpenter's the thing.
Oh, yeah.
We should point out that initially they wanted to do the werewolf transformation in one uncut shot. And on their budget and with 1980 technology, they're like, yeah, there's no way we're going to be able to do this. It was just really cool to think about.
Yeah, it was definitely a good goal to have. I mean, in the past, it was always cuts and dissolves and everything. You know, I'm thinking of like Lon Chaney Jr. with the, you know, the hair growing on his face while, you know, Bud Abbott's watching him and everything. It was a good goal to have. But yeah, unfortunately, you know, you had to look at something like, you know, The Howling 7, where they did a beautiful morph between a woman's face and a horrible wolf head costume.
Halloween mask.
Yeah, which really, you know, that's where the money was in that film, was that, you know, 5-second morph effect that was probably cutting edge for 1995. That was back when Michael Jackson was morphing into all those people in his one video.
I think you mean in real life as well. I just want to say people should not look at the sequels as a bad thing. Each one is their own individual movie. Go into at least the first three with an open mind, because two is fun, not in the way it's meant to be, but it is. And three, like Mike and I both pointed out, is pretty decent, actually.
Yeah, and three right now is streaming on Netflix, so... You know, if you got Netflix, take a chance. You know, nothing wrong with checking it out, and there's some good fun to it.
And I think due to all the different companies that own the rights, we're never going to get a box set of all seven. I refuse to deal with that new one, Mike, so seven is where I cut it off. Because I think the first one is available individually, the second one is available individually, 3, 4, and 5 are available individually, and then there's another set that's got 4, 5, 6, and 7 in it. But you just cannot get a box set with all of them due to rights issues, which kind of sucks.
Yeah, I would just avoid 4 through 7, like the play. Well, 4 through 7 or 4 through 8, however you want to put it. Just, yeah, stop yourself at 3. It's just like, you know, when you're going back for second, third helpings at Thanksgiving, stop with the third one. Don't go for the fourth.
Sometimes you just have to push away from the table.
And say, no more Jell-O for me, Mom. All right, we're going to take another break and play back a preview from next week's show.
The clock is dead.
Destroy all monsters. Sticky figments. Sticky figments. I'm sick of them. Picture bits carried by cosmic rays. The strange case of the cosmic rays. Plutonium piles. Inside this pyramid. She's in a man-made mountain on the moon. Hollow moon. Some rays still penetrate this deep. So many picture stories. All of them are true. Read them in the rocks like a crystal ball. Moving images and voices, too. Bad memories and worse fantasies. Bad copies of bad men stuck in the muck. Tainted and tangled and mangled the memory banks. Bunched and bundled, burnt into my brain, branded onto dead meat. This sick puppet has been attacked. Attached to. In nerves, there are narratives. But there is a way to slough them off, as there's a way to free that prison planet called Earth. Every day and every way, we are building a bridge to the white light. And so she toils to ground the colony, our picture processing station. We expunge the embeds and drop our doll bodies, because L. Ron's got the tech. L. Ron Hubbard's got the tech.
We welcome you as a new servant of the glorious planet. We have implanted our life in your brain, and you are now our slave. We'll do what we tell you.
Back next week with Mock Up on Mood. This is the first of two special episodes. We're going to take a look at L. Ron Hubbard and Scientology in film. Be sure to come back. We talk about this avant-garde film about sex and rocket ships with director Craig Baldwin. Now, before we close out the show this week, I want to thank our special guest host once again, Mr. Josh Hadley. So, Josh, what's going on in your world, in your many crazy podcasts?
Well, still doing the writing. I'm investigating neo-Nazis for Hustler, writing for Grindhouse Purgatory magazine. Just got everything going on over at geekjuicemedia.com, 1201beyond.com, and the Radiodrome, Lost in the Static, What the F***, Geek Juice Radio. Hopefully cinema is coming soon. We're about to be relaunching the Thum podcast. Yeah, I'm a little bit busy.
The Thum podcast?
It's a comic book podcast, you know, thum, like a sound effect in a comic book. Thum, when somebody gets punched.
Well, actually, we'll be joining you over there at Geek Juice Media. It's kind of interesting.
You and Mike are the newest contributors to Geek Juice Media, and I think you fit perfectly.
Better than my pants. I don't fit into those anymore at all.
Rob, do you want to help him with his pants a little bit?
Mike, you're supposed to watch the 8 Howling films. You're not supposed to shove them into your pants.
Thanks again, Josh, and thanks to everyone for listening. Be sure to stop by the website for more goodies about the Howling and to leave us some feedback. That's at projection-booth.com. Or, yeah, you can check us over at geekjuicemedia.com. Geekjuicemedia.com. I don't know if I would ever want to drink any geek juice, but we can keep that between us. And don't forget to call us about our upcoming VHS extravaganza episode.
That's right. Did you work in a video store? Did you frequent one? You know, that area where they have the curtain back there. Well, make sure to give us a ring and share your memories. You can leave the message at 734-666-0800. That's right, 734, of course, 666 0800 and leave us your memories all about VHS. Why did you love it? How did it change your life? You know, maybe you shot something incriminating and you're still blackmailing someone with the tape. And feel free to give us a call. And remember, no operators will be standing by.
Werewolf?
There.
What?
There, wolf. There, castle.